What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks.
We do Palestine Post on Mondays, but just like last week, we're going to focus on the genocide occurring in the region for 2 days in a row. As of this morning, and at the time I started prepping for this segment, according to Al Jazeera, 45 people have been murdered by Israel since dawn. That number has definitely increased, including 18 aid seekers. Israel's genocide, I refuse to call it a war, has killed, murdered at least 66,055 people and wounded 168,346 since October 2023. Thousands more are believed to be buried under the rubble. We know from global researchers that that number of dead is likely much closer to over 80,000. People. Joining us to discuss headlines and analysis updates is Chris Hedges, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, author, and former foreign correspondent for the New York Times, known for his sharp critiques of war, empire, capitalism, and the erosion of civil liberties in the United States. He's the author of Genocide Foretold, reporting on survival and resistance in occupied Palestine. Good morning, Chris. Good to see you again. Thanks for coming back on the show.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
And I know it's super early for you, so double thanks for being here.
Oh, no, I'm on the East Coast.
Oh, okay. All right. Somebody said it was 5 a.m. I was like, wow.
No. I'm headed for Australia pretty soon, so okay. That'll be a time warp.
Well, that's good that I caught you before then. We're going to spend most of our time together. Chris, I'm sure that we'll, you know, take diversionary paths talking about this 20-point plan. We appear to be at yet another potential ceasefire juncture with Trump's plan now under review by Hamas. Yesterday, Bibi said at a press conference that he would accept the plan, which includes a release of the remaining hostages, an immediate end to hostilities in the area. It also requires an end to Hamas having any say-so or power in the area and the implementation of a transitional government, of which former British Prime Minister Tony Blair, who was the United States partner, I'm just for my guess, not you, because you know this, the United States partner in uplifting the false reasoning for invading Iraq and murdering all of those people there. And new development as last night and this morning, along with, in partnership with Donald Trump. I'll just pause there for your response.
Right. Well, the plan, like all these plans, is so amorphous. Israel can do whatever it wants. There's no timetable. Many of the bullet points are only a sentence long. They posit all sorts of programs or scenarios that, for instance, creating a multinational force, but nobody has said that they would actually provide troops for that force. Where will Israel withdraw to? It doesn't say. Israel says it will keep the borders. Of course, complete disempowerment with Hamas. So this is just one more opaque agreement that allows Israel to do whatever it wants, which it will. Of course, what Israel would like and what the Palestinians would like is that hostage exchange. There are thousands of Palestinians, including women and children, who have been held sometimes for decades by Israel. And initially, the whole October 7th incursion into Israel and the seizing of Israeli hostages was about a prisoner exchange, which is how Yahya Sinwar, one of the architects of the incursion, was released. Israel could have ended the conflict on October 8th if they had agreed to empty the Israeli prisons, and then Hamas would have returned the hostages. But that, of course, didn't play into the Israel's decision to essentially use the incursions on October 7th as a way to ethnically cleanse Gaza, obliterate Gaza, and drive the Palestinians out of the Gaza Strip. That has not changed. That remains the goal. Israeli cabinet members like Smotrich and others, Ben-Gavir, are quite upfront about it. So if Israel can get Hamas to free the remaining hostages, there's estimated 20 that are still alive, and in exchange for prisoners, I suspect that would be the best that would come out of this. The other thing Israel has a habit of doing, and it did this, has done this with the two ceasefires that have taken place since the genocide began, is claim mendaciously that Hamas is violating the ceasefire and then Israel just breaks it. So I don't expect much from this. It replicates all the other vague, amorphous, undefined agreements. The best that could come out of it is an exchange of hostages. Beyond that, I don't see anything impeding the goal of Israel, which is, I mean, let's be clear. First of all, Gaza doesn't exist anymore. I mean, Gaza has been pounded into submission, is just a landscape of rubble and debris. And then, of course, Israel is bringing in excavating equipment to tear down these ruined buildings, to level everything. That isn't going to change. They've gotten away with it for almost 2 years. They don't intend to stop now. And of course, they're turning on the West Bank. So that trajectory, which is not denied particularly by the Netanyahu government, will continue. This peace plan, quote unquote, peace plan, isn't going to stop it.
So for me, one of the things that let's move forward with this is the idea that Trump would lead this transitional government, meaning that he would be the power person for two countries. Is that even plausible? And B, as I'm thinking about, if we put this in the context, right, of Trump's plans to turn the Gaza Strip into a Riviera, I know neither of us had cameras or recordings inside of that meeting happened with Trump and Netanyahu, but it seems to me that economic interest might be the only thing that would have gotten Netanyahu to say, sure, knowing that they have no intention of actually there being a self-determined Palestine in the first place.
No, I think Netanyahu fully understands that he can continue to do whatever he wants without any real impediment from the United States. The whole plan of this transitional authority, perhaps led by Tony Blair, of all people, who, and let's be clear, Blair's entire political career is a creation of Zionist money, when Blair first started his campaign as a parliamentarian to become prime minister, he took significant money from wealthy Zionists, and that allowed him to betray the unions because he didn't need union support. He didn't need their financial support anymore. And he has just been a puppet of the Israel lobby ever since. So he's reviled within the Middle East, not only for Iraq, but also because he's just a stooge for Israel. So, of course, that's why he was picked. And his vaunted, you know, what was it, 6 or 8 years that he was supposed to negotiate peace within the region really came up with nothing. He's utterly obsequious to the most retrograde, Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia. I mean, so he has zero credibility, but Israel loves him because his whole political career, he's danced to the tune that Israel has played. But I don't think we'll ever get to that point. I think this is all smoke and mirrors. Israel always, every peace agreement they sign going all the way back to Oslo or Camp David is always done in phases. And they get what they want in the first phase, and then they violate every other phase. That was true with Camp David, which was supposed to see, for instance, East Jerusalem returned to Palestinian Authority. I mean, all sorts of things were written in there that just never came to pass. That was true with Oslo. That's why Edward Said, when Arafat signed it, called him the Peyton of the Palestinian people. And this is just for those of us who've been covering the region for many years. This is exactly how it has always worked and will continue to work. So to treat this as any kind of a serious peace plan is extremely foolish and naive.
I have intentionally not called it a peace plan. There's nothing about this that is peaceful. Two white dudes coming into an Arab country and saying, we're going to control it and we're going to tell you what to, like, there's nothing about the
trade. Let's count Netanyahu. It's three.
I think my brain on purpose X's him out of the conversation. I'm going to try not to frustrate either you or me by tugging on more threads of this plan. I do think some things are important to expose. But before I go further in this, you said, Chris, that there's 20 Israeli hostages believed to still be alive. What number did we start at?
The hard number was, I think it was 200 and something. Of course, some of those were dead, and some of the remaining or figures who are missing are dead. And there was a significant, in the first ceasefire, significant hostage exchange. I forget the number. I can't remember. 70 or, it was significant. Most of the hostages have been released. I would also add that those hostages have largely been killed by Israel. And Netanyahu is fully aware of that, and that's why you see so much opposition within Israel, especially led by the families of those who've been taken hostage.
As I try to look into the Zionist crystal ball about all of the ways in which Netanyahu will back out of the ceasefire, try to justify it, that being one of them, right? That blaming Hamas for the Israeli hostages that, in fact, the IDF bombed.
Yeah, I mean, they create all sorts of lurid stories about how when hostages' bodies are returned, how they were tortured or whatever. But the fact is, and hostages who have been released have confirmed this, the saturation bombing and indiscriminate bombing on the part of Israel has certainly terminated, we don't know the numbers, but certainly terminated the lives of a significant number of Israelis who are being held.
Chris, I just
remember you had two or three young men who escaped, and they approached the IDF with their shirts off and their hands up, shouting in Hebrew, and they were just gunned down.
At the time Netanyahu and Trump made the announcement that Israel had accepted the plan, Hamas hadn't even said it yet. And both Netanyahu and Trump together said that Hamas had 4 days to respond or else. For organizations that are fighting on behalf of liberation of the people, there's a relationship that you're in with the people, that organizations are in with the people. The terms of the degrading terms of this agreement, what kind, and based on where you sit and your understanding of relationships with folks inside that organization, what kind of position does this politically put Hamas in and or impact their relation with the Palestinian people?
Well, a precondition is that Hamas doesn't exist, that they disarm and they disband, and which isn't going to happen. So I don't see how that's a condition that Hamas is ever going to accept. I mean, Hamas was elected. You may not like them. It doesn't matter. They were elected in free elections in 2006. Unlike the Palestinian Authority, which Mahmoud Abbas hasn't had an election in years, and of course, the Palestinian Authority, which really just functions as a colonial police force, is reviled by Palestinians. It was in the West Bank last summer. The ultimate preconditions are ones that Hamas is not going to accept, because what they're really asked to do is accept their own destruction. And that isn't going to happen. And I think Netanyahu is quite aware of that.
That's right. I mean, that was going to be my next, I guess, follow-up statement was that, and they know this, right? They know this, but then I'm like, well, maybe the arrogance of the colonizers is such that they believe that the brown people will be like, you're right. We don't, you're right. We don't matter. And we'll sack, or that they believe that things have gotten dire enough that Hamas would say it's worth the sacrifice of their humanity to get the bombing to stop. But I don't know that my guess is Hamas believes even less than we do that the bombing will actually stop anyway. And that also does not represent, as far as what I understand, to be the resistance spirits of the Palestinian people.
Yeah, Hamas is, it's all a very cynical game. Hamas fully understands what Israel is doing. And Israel, the Netanyahu government, fully understands that Hamas understands what they're doing. If this was a viable plan to create a Palestinian state and end the conflict, Netanyahu wouldn't touch it.
So what's the point of the performance, Chris Hazard?
Well, the point of the performance, remember, if that Hamas doesn't accept it, then in Trump's word, Israel can finish the job. It can do whatever it wants. So then you've had a kind of endorsement of the final stage of the genocide, where of course we're talking about mass starvation of the Palestinian people, and then the luring, the using of paltry food shipments in the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation to lure hungry Palestinians, starving Palestinians to the south. There isn't anywhere near enough food. That's why you have the riots and everyone getting shot. The point is, it's bait. And then once they're there, they're not allowed to go back to the north. They're contained in concentration camps. So it's a way of, it's just become the weaponization of starvation and the weaponization of food to depopulate all the northern Gaza and keep Palestinians. I mean, they're talking about hundreds of thousands of Palestinians being held in these concentration camps, completely surrounded by crazed U.S. mercenaries and the IDF, who I don't know what the number is now, but have killed or wounded thousands of Palestinians as they've come for food. I mean, the whole process is very cynical, that it's done for 1 hour, 2 in the morning. They keep the crowds of Palestinians back through gunfire. Then they unleash them on these piles of boxes that are just dumped in the sand. People carry knives either to protect themselves or to steal food or to cut the plastic is quite thick if they have to cut it off. I mean, it's just madness. And that's why you have constant killing. So it's not, the whole mechanism or the whole machinery which has been put in place by Israel is not going to change. They have made it very clear. I mean, they're already talking about Jewish settlements or colonies being implanted in Gaza. You actually have Zionists traveling through the United States selling plots of land that people can buy if they want to go live in Gaza. The real sticking point for Israel is they don't know where these people are going to go, because the Egyptian government has just been adamant about not allowing Egypt to push the Palestinians. There's a 9-mile border between Egypt and Gaza, to push them over the border into the northern Sinai, into the Egyptian Sinai. So they've been in talks with the Sudan, with Somaliland, with Somalia, to essentially take for remuneration. They would give them an economic incentive to take Palestinians. None of this it will change. The genocide is too far advanced. There are questions about the denouement, how it will end, but that it will end and that Israel will carry it out, I think, is incontrovertible. There are only two ways to stop Israel. One is, of course, cutting all arms shipments, which the Trump administration is not going to do. Israel depleted its stockpiles months ago. It's completely reliant on U.S. stockpiles of munitions and spare parts and equipment and everything else. And then even the things like the U.K., which has very cynically recognized a Palestinian state, it's only cut its arms shipments to Israel by 10%. And so I think it's just a way of kind of whitewashing the complicity of European governments and Starmer and others in the genocide. So the other way to stop it would be for an intervention, a breaking the Israeli blockade with naval vessels from Turkey and, I don't know, France, Spain, other countries, to provide humanitarian aid and imposing a no-fly zone over Gaza. I don't see that happening either. That is what happened at the end of the first Gulf War. I was there in northern Iraq when the Kurds were being driven over the mountain passes and dying in droves that the Iraqis were forced to withdraw below the 38th parallel, and there was a no-fly zone. So those are the two ways that the genocide could be halted. But I don't see the powers in the global north doing it. The only country that has actively attempted to halt the genocide is Yemen.
Given those two scenarios, Chris Hedges, how critical, crucial, or what needs to be shifted about the global resistance movement demanding a free Palestine in terms of the pressure of the people?
I mean, look at Palestine Action. So it's, Palestine Action, of course, is, in the words of the UK government, been declared a proscribed group. That's essentially what we call a terrorist group. But you've had all sorts of people showing up willing to be arrested. Because just to claim that you support Palestine Action means you can be charged. So I think it's mass acts of civil disobedience, number one, and that would include, of course, not loading the ships that provide, not loading the, within dock workers, refusing to load ships with weapons supplies for Israel.
That takes us to 8:30.
So hopefully people in Oakland are listening to this.
People in Oakland are definitely listening to this. And I thank you, because I was actually just going to do a segue announcement to remind Oaklanders that some of those parts that Chris Hedges was talking about that are being shipped to Israel are being shipped out of the Oakland airport. Our local Arab organizations have alerted us to. And so there's a campaign that has been launched, the Oakland Arms Embargo Campaign. You can follow them on Instagram at that that label, Oakland Arms Embargo. Stay tuned for information about more movement happening on October 4th. Where do I want to go next with you, Chris? Less discussed groups, but who are actually, don't know that I've spent any time talking about these folks on this show, who are active and express concerns about the Trump plan and the PYA, are the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, which has fought alongside Hamas, and the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. Who are these folks, Chris, and where do they sit in the...
I knew one of the co-founders of Hamas, Dr. Abdul Aziz Rantisi, quite well, actually. And it's a national liberation group, without question. These are national liberation groups. They're not terrorist groups. Do they use terror? Yes. But every national liberation group, including those underground Zionist groups pre-1948, they are Gun, Stern Gang, they also used terror, including blowing up the King David Hotel and killing all, I think, 61 people or something. So that's not to condone it, but it is a misnomer to call Hamas a terrorist group. When I was with Rantisi, that is the language they used. As a national liberation group, I mean, things have changed. Rantisi was assassinated with his son and one of his bodyguards in 2004. Sheikh Yassin was also assassinated, I think, about the same year by Israel. So, and you ended up with figures like Yahya Sinwar. Rantisi was highly educated, came out of the political wing of Hamas. He was a pediatrician, graduated first in his class at the University of Alexandria. Yahya Sinwar came out of the security branch of Hamas, which by its nature, of course, is more brutal. Because that's his job. I mean, part of the job was to execute collaborators, which Sinwar and others did. So I didn't know Sinwar. I can't tell you the exact. I think Hamas as an organization, as a centralized organization, is pretty clear doesn't exist. The resistance is really devolved into small bands of fighters who, at, of course, tremendous risk, will attack Israeli armored personnel carriers or plant homemade IEDs or this kind of stuff. But it is a national liberation group. Like any other national liberation group, I was in Jerusalem and covered the bus bombings that Hamas carried out. I was vehemently opposed to those indiscriminate attacks on civilians. That was an opinion I expressed to Rantisi in his home. My argument was that you have the moral authority, and by carrying out those kinds of indiscriminate attacks on civilians, you're squandering it. His answer was just to pull out statistics on the number of Palestinian children who have been killed, which of course dwarfs the number of Israeli children killed. And he said, when they stop killing our children, we'll stop killing their children. I never bought that argument. But yeah, it is. Look, I've been in the Middle East quite a bit since. I just came back from Egypt. My third trip to Egypt. I've been to Qatar twice doing broadcasting for Al Jazeera. I spent last summer in Jordan and the West Bank. And on Arab streets, Hamas is lionized. I mean, the demonstrations in Amman when I was there, they were chanting, "We are all Hamas." So the way Hamas is viewed in the Arab world and in the global South is diametrically opposed to the way it's painted here within the United States.
I mean, I think, and I mean, I don't know how far down this road we want to go. I do think the last 2 years have reopened a door to have a conversation about what right oppressed peoples have to engage in armed resistance. We just lost, humanity, you know, Assata Shakur just transitioned, which I think has also opened up that conversation because people are both uplifting her and Kamala Harris in the same post, which is frustrating to a lot of folks like myself. I think as a conversation that on the left we shy away from. But I do think it's an important part of the conversation. Like, at what point do oppressed people, murdered people, terrorized people, traumatized people, people that are being starved to death, have a right to say, we've had enough?
Well, they have every right. I mean, under international law, the Palestinians have a right to resist, including the use of armed force. I mean, that's just not debatable. Of course they have a right. I don't like violence. I've been around a lot of it. But it's always the oppressor who determines the configuration of resistance. So every time the Palestinians attempted to resist nonviolently, including the Great March of Return, where they marched up to the fence, Israeli snipers gunned them all down. They gunned down medics, they gunned down journalists, they gunned down disabled people, they gunned down children. I mean, so it's Israel that determined how the coloring of the resistance. If there was a viable peace process, if there was a viable route to a Palestinian state, then you wouldn't need groups like Hamas. Remember, Hamas was created along with the first Intifada. It was created in response to Arafat's agreement in the Oslo Accords to essentially give up the right of return. What's the right of return? The right of return. So 75% of the people in Gaza, about 2.1 million people, 75% of those people are either refugees or descendants of refugees from Israel. They were driven out during the so-called Nakba catastrophe in 1948. Well, when Arafat sold those people out, the rage towards Fatah saw people back a group like Hamas that called for the right of return, that did not give up this fundamental call for the Palestinian people. And of course, they have every right to return. I mean, the idea that you're born in Brooklyn and you fly to Tel Aviv and you get a passport because you're Jewish, where if your family is Palestinian and has lived in historic Palestine for, let's be clear, centuries, and you can't even go back to your home or get citizenship. I mean, the flagrant kind of discrepancy between how indigenous Palestinians are treated and colonizers are treated is, of course, part of the problem. So, yeah, it's of course they have every. I hate violence. I hate it. But at the same time, you know, I was in Sarajevo during the war. I covered the war in Salvador. I was a Salvadoran, or if I was a Sarajevan, I would have picked up a gun too. Not a happy choice, but of course they have absolutely every right to resist.
When we got to chat in person, time is a blur, 2 months ago, I think, at this point, and you were presenting your latest book and just in general your analysis of what's happening in the region. Something that stayed with me about that night was the portion of your presentation where you talked about the cost for the folks imposing this terror on the Palestinian people. You have reported on a number of wars and been in close proximity to people that are doing awful things to other human beings. Can you talk a little bit about that and also why that is a piece of the presentation?
Sure. I mean, you know, this isn't a war, of course, as you correctly point out. It's a slaughter. I mean, it's the decimation of a people. I mean, in fact, at least until recently, Hamas fighters were able to shelter in tunnels, which the general population was not. And I have many friends in Gaza, and they have expressed a certain anger towards Hamas in leaving them exposed. They also have expressed the anger at the fact that with Hamas in control, families often had an AK-47 in the closet. They were completely stripped of their weapons, something people don't know. Only Hamas security and Hamas Qassam brigades were allowed to carry weapons. The average Gazan was not allowed to have a weapon. It was complete and full gun control. And as one of my friends said, you know, at least if we'd had a gun, we could have resisted. We could have done something to fight back, but it was taken from us, and not by the Israelis, but by Hamas. The cost. Well, I mean, look, you see it as all sorts of suicides within the Israeli army. People being, you know, having to go for being medicated, the typical kinds of psychological trauma that affects all sorts of people who, you know, including our own soldiers, Marines, or in Iraq and Afghanistan and everywhere else. So. And that gets back to this point that it's a vast killing field. So Israel has the fourth largest army in the world. It has mechanized units and navy, and it uses its navy, by the way, to bombard Gaza. It has Air Force, F-35s. It has tank brigades, et cetera. The Palestinians have none of that. It's just slaughter. And yes, there's resistance, but one of the things that angers me the way the conflict is reported is this notion of equivalency, as if militarily Hamas or the resistance movements are equivalent to Israel, which is ridiculous. Israel wants to peddle that fiction. Unfortunately, the mainstream press perpetuates it, but there is no equivalency. Both in terms of military capacity, but also in terms of atrocities. The bulk of the atrocities are carried out against the Palestinian people by Israel, and that has historically always been true. That has never changed. But that equivalency allows you a kind of moral pass. You'll see all sorts of liberals who feign, you know, some kind of compassion for the Palestinians will always go back to that equivalency. You know, well, Hamas says Israel shouldn't exist, which, by the way, isn't true. It's another discussion. And that equivalency is part of the effort to mask what's actually happening and mask the genocide. There are terrible repercussions. We know anecdotally from Israel, a huge brain drain, a flight. I mean, they hide the numbers, but the estimates are up to 500,000 people. Because, of course, they're colonists, so they have other passports and they can leave. They're not originally from Israel, or their families are certainly not originally from Israel. Netanyahu's family is Polish. So, it has reverberations within the society itself in terms of a breakdown of social bonds, and that is also what we're seeing. We should also be clear that part of this project, and we haven't spoken about the West Bank, but the West Bank is clearly targeted. Israel has now seized 80% of the West Bank, but they've also handed out thousands, I think 10,000 initially, automatic weapons to colonists in the West Bank. There are 750,000 Jewish colonists living on Palestinian land in the West Bank, and allowed them to function as death squads and rogue militias, with no impediment. And by empowering the settler or the colonist movement has taken over Israel. It used to be when I actually lived in Jerusalem. When I lived in Israel, these colonists were not allowed to be the heads of security services, the heads of the military. They were actually outlawed. I was there when the Rabbi Meir Kahana, who was a fanatic, I mean, fascist, let's call him what he was, Jewish fascist, his party, the Koch party, was outlawed. He was banned. Not that liberal Zionism treated Palestinians any better. They didn't. And you could even argue they treated them until now worse because they were in charge in 1948 and in 1967 in the 67 war when 350,000 Palestinians were ethnically cleansed. That was more, these old Abba Iban and figures. They were used to make Zionism palatable to the West. But for the Palestinians, it didn't make a lot of difference. But what you've seen now is a capturing of political and military control by the colonist movement. And these are messianic. I mean, they're talking about tearing down, ripping down Al-Aqsa, the third holiest site in Islam, to rebuild the temple that was destroyed by the Romans in 70 AD. This is just utter insanity. Of course, we see it in our own country. It's very much replicates the magical thinking that is peddled by many in the Trump administration. So Israel has changed. It's become a despotic, theocratic, repressive. And let's just not forget that those not many Israelis have stood up against the genocide. In fact, very few. Some of the Israeli group B'Tselem would be an example, a very heroic journalist at Aretz, Gideon Levy, and Amir Ahas, but they're just complete pariahs within the country. I mean, the Israeli press is just a full-throated cheerleading machine for genocide. And let's not, castigate Israel, because our press did the same, I know, because I fought it, when we invaded Iraq. Israel society has been deeply deformed, deeply damaged. I think probably irrevocably, it's become a pariah state. All of these goons and thugs that are terrorizing Palestinians will shut down any form of dissent within Israel. Max Blumenthal wrote a pretty good book, Goliath, on modern Israel. If you want to read it, I thought it was very good. Of course, it doesn't compare with, of course, what's happening to the Palestinians. I mean, I have friends whose entire extended families have been destroyed because Gaza's one of the most densely packed places on earth. But Palestinian families tend to live on the same street, often in the same apartment block. So when there's a strike, you just have generations wiped out. But I have friends who 150, extended family members gone.
Same. And I think about generational impact, right? And we'll start with the Palestinians. That kind of trauma that doesn't just go away. There's not enough therapy in the world for that kind of trauma.
Well, it doesn't end. I mean, so it's not a traumatic incident. It's constant trauma. Trauma, and I'm not just talking about the genocide. This has been true in Gaza for decades. Because, Israel cynically calls it mowing the lawn. Well, it means using sophisticated attack aircraft to bomb most of Gaza's slum. There are some nice parts of it, but most of it's a big slum. And just drop our 500-pound iron fragmentation bombs on refugee camps. So, that trauma is... of course, the genocide ratchets it up to a whole other level. But how are these kids, how are these people going to recover, number one? And number two, we know there's going to be blowback. I mean, they will attempt to, people whose entire families were wiped out, mothers and fathers and brothers and sisters were killed wantonly. Of course, they're going to respond, and we would be no different. So the consequences of this will not end whenever it ends. The consequences will be with us for a long time, and they won't be pretty.
Chris Hedges, do you think that there's predictions that we can make about how or what kinds of, there'll be myriad responses, but what kinds of possible responses may spring up organically based on the kind of responses we saw from the folks in Iraq after what was done to them so brutally and violently?
Well, if you don't have an air, if you don't have a fighter jet, what do? You wrap yourself in explosives. And I mean, if they had a fighter jet, they'd use it. I mean, we have to be clear that what Israel is doing and what we did is state terrorism, which is far more vicious and kills far more people. I mean, we certainly murdered far more people, including children, with our missiles and drones and iron fragmentation bombs than ISIS ever did. But that's not something that is ever recognized by the oppressor. Yeah, of course they will attempt to strike back, and it, just as any human being would. Again, I don't like it. I don't, and I fear it, and but it's inevitable, and it's what any people who suffered what the Palestinians are suffering would do.
You've said something a couple of times. This next question might annoy you, and I apologize, but I have been sitting on it since we met in person and had our conversation. You don't like violence. You hate violence. Yet you have spent decades mired in it and talking about it and reporting on it, and yet have somehow held on to your humanity. Talk about that.
Yeah, although being in wars certainly fed a dark side. I write about it in my book, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. I became an adrenaline junkie like all people who go into combat, whether journalists or soldiers or Marines. They call it a combat high. It's very real. I suffer trauma, which alienates you from a world not at war. I liken it. I've never taken drugs, but I liken it to a drug addiction. But of course, I never carried a weapon. I never hurt anyone. I took tremendous risks, and I don't want to pretend I was Mother Teresa. Part of those risks were part of my own dark pathology. But the risks were taken to make it hard for those who committed atrocities to hide them. So, for instance, in places like El Salvador, or when the army would carry out a massacre in a village, they would block the roads. We'd have to walk in. We were often fired upon. That also happened to me in Bosnia. It happened to me in Kosovo. Of course, colleagues, including my closest friend, were killed. Covering war. A few dozen people I worked with were killed. I wrote what I wrote and did what I did, like my good friend Robert Fisk, because I desperately did not want those voices and that suffering to be disappeared or erased. So I just came back from Egypt. I was with the cartoonist Joe Sacco, and we interviewed Palestinians from Gaza, and we are writing a book called Requiem for Gaza. Joe, of course, is drawing it out because it's just a tiny effort on our part to counter the erasure, because like all genocides, this is about attempting to wipe from the face of history, wipe away the culture. I mean, the 12 universities in Gaza are all destroyed. And wipe away memory. And so, at least he is a cartoonist, a great cartoonist, and his two books, Palestine and Footnotes in Gaza, are brilliant. I mean, the other thing is we both spent a lot of time in Gaza. We have friends in Gaza. So it's a way to counter that erasure. And that's what I attempted to do as a journalist, and that's what I'm attempting to do as an author.
I ask you the question that I hate the most when people ask it of me, and my exposure to trauma very different than yours. But I'm gonna repeat the second half of the question, which is how have you? You're still doing the work. You're still mired in the violence. There has to be something that you've done to address the kind of shattering that happens when you sit in man's inhumanity to man 24/7, 365.
Well, I don't go back into war zones. So, I mean, we were in Egypt interviewing Palestinians, but I wasn't in Gaza. So I stopped active. I mean, I did it for 20 years, hardly a war I missed. But I don't go into war zones. That said, dealing with this material, even though I did the interviews, and I know Joe feels the same, is even as I'm writing it or he's drawing it, it's just so overwhelming. We have to stop. It's a cost. It's I come out of seminary. It's called bearing your cross. You don't want to bear it, and it's painful and hard. It's not something I do by choice. On the other hand, and Joe called me just a few weeks into the genocide and said, we have to do a book. We have to. This is what we're called to do. Of course, there is a price, and the big price being that I don't sleep. But in a way, not to do it is a betrayal, not only of my role as a writer, my role as a reporter, but also a betrayal of people I care about in Palestine.
Chris Hedges, I want to thank you so much for saying yes to a second conversation with me, and thank you so much for your work.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA, that's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. Our Resistance in Residence theme music was composed by Jesse Strauss. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA, that's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listeners. If you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.